Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Representative Bruce Scoggs' bill to ban cities from having anti-discrimination laws preventing bigotry in public accommodations, housing, and employment makes it out of Idaho House Committee and will go to the House floor. ICE attacks thousands of demonstrators unprovoked in Portland on Saturday. And University of Idaho biology professor Jack Sullivan talks about the use of machine learning to help with biodiversity crisis the world's going through. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House Local Government Committee voted mostly along party lines for a law that would erase all 13 anti-discrimination ordinances in the state that protect gay and lesbian people, as well as transgender people, from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. Opponents say House Bill 559, written by Christian nationalist group the Idaho Family Policy Center and sponsored by Republican Representative Bruce Scoggs of Nampa, puts the interests of certain Idaho businesses ahead of the safety of Idaho residents. 13 Idaho cities have passed the non-discrimination laws since 2011 that protect the gay and trans communities from discrimination. They are Sandpoint, Boise, Idaho Falls, Moscow, Lewiston, Meridian, Ketchum, Haley, Bellevue, Driggs, Victor, Pocatello, and Coeur d'Alene. The Sandpoint City Council repealed their anti-discrimination ordinance in November, with Mayor Jeremy Grimm casting the tie-breaking vote. Ada County also has a law that bans discrimination against gay and transgender people. Scoggs claims the anti-bigotry laws threaten religious freedoms and harm businesses. Victor City Council member Sue Lancaster testified against the proposed law. Here's Lancaster, followed by Misty Delicarpini-Tolman, who is the regional political and Idaho State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates.
I, however, still strongly oppose this attempt to take away both local control and anti-discrimination policies that protect people based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. Finding the state's anti-discrimination laws did not adequately protect discrimination against LGBTQ people, the City of Victor tightened our ordinance in 2014. This law specifically takes away local control to welcome everyone into our community. Everyone. I want to speak briefly about the economic impact of anti-discrimination ordinances. In Victor, our experience has been that openness is not an economic disadvantage. It's an economic strength, as Representative Church pointed out. Small rural towns compete for people first, skilled workers, entrepreneurs, young families, and remote professionals who can choose where to live. A reputation for fairness and predictability helps us attract and retain that talent. It supports small business creation, protects our visitor economy, and stabilizes property values, which in turn supports our tax base and public services. Our ordinance has not created hardship or conflict. It has provided clarity and reduced uncertainty for employers, landlords, and residents. Mr. Scoggs specifically is a hotbed of liberalism, while listing communities that would be affected by this bill. The definition of liberalism is a political and moral philosophy centered on the protection of individual rights, liberty, consent of the governed, and equity before the law. It advocates for limited government, democracy, free markets, and secularism, prioritizing individual autonomy over collective or state power. I personally believe the source of all evil is the belief that some lives matter more than others. Taking local control away is the opposite of a small government. And I believe that as it stands, this ordinance is un-American, unconstitutional, and even un-Christian. And we, the people of Victor, do not support it.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Misty Deli Carpini-Tolman. I am the Regional Political and Idaho State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates, and we are here in strong opposition to House Bill 557. This bill removes the ability for local governments to protect its residents and puts business owner interests over the safety of its citizens. This weekend, the Treasure Valley Partnership reported on critical issues of growth, and one thing that stood out to me was this statement that public safety is non-negotiable. A thriving region can't function with unstaffed fire stations, aging police fleets, or overcrowded jails. Former Boise Chief of Police Mike Masterson, who ran against the mayor of Boise in this last election, disagreed with her on almost everything except the NDO. He said the NDO in Boise was critical for recruitment and retention of officers and other emergency personnel. In fact, he urged the city to adopt the NDO to help build trust so he could do his job better, saying non-discrimination protection is an important message that you as elected officials send to your constituents and to all Idahoans about what you value in terms of justice and trust. The state may have the power to preempt, but using that power to block local civil rights protections is a policy choice that runs counter to Idaho's commitment to local decision-making. Sponsors cite the need for uniformity as the motivation for this legislation. Uniformity should not come as a sweeping denial of basic human rights. Instead of lowering the standards to the lowest common denominator, this body should listen to its constituents who have been asking for over 15 years for statewide protections. Rather than banning cities from doing better for their residents, uniformity could be accomplished by adding gender identity and sexual orientation to the Idaho Human Rights Act. HB 557 sends a dangerous message that the legislature would prefer to strip its citizens of protections rather than to expand them. In the absence of the legislature taking action, local leaders have stepped up to protect their constituents. Local governments aren't contradicting state law, they're filling gaps. Idaho residents have consistently sent the message that their cities and their homes should be a loving and safe place for everybody, and the local leaders have listened. This bill takes power away from the people, sending the message that opinions and ideologies are more important than the safety of the residents themselves. Preemption doesn't create fairness. It enforces a one-size-fits-all approach that silences local voices and would allow discrimination to go unchecked. It fosters a culture of exclusion and legalizes the discrimination of the LGBTQ communities. What's more, HB 557 would allow any private citizen to sue their local government if non-discrimination ordinances are expanded or enforced, setting up a scenario where the very people who demonstrate to us the need for these protections have the power to sue for the right to discriminate. LGBTQ plus communities continue to experience widely unfair treatment, especially in this moment of increasing political rhetoric. Our friends and neighbors are living in fear. Nobody should have to live in fear of losing their jobs or their housing simply because of who they are or who they love. When everyone is treated fairly, we all prosper. Please vote no on House Bill 557.
Thank you, Ms. Tolman. I'm sorry I leave the rest of the part of your name off. But
no, that's okay. It's a hard last name.
Yes. Committee, are there any questions for Ms. Tolman? Okay, excellent. Seeing none.
I have a couple seconds left in mine, I would like to answer Representative Holstetler's question that he asked the previous person.
Well,
would that be allowed?
I would say you probably didn't have time, but if Representative Holstetler would like to ask that again, then you could answer that.
You don't have to. I just have a thought.
Madam Chair, thank you for your presentation. And I would ask you the same thing. We keep hearing a lot about, religion being imposed and persecution. I don't see any of that in this bill. So once again, I would ask, when we have heard of it the other way with several examples, do you believe that cities have the right to impose their will upon the right of the conscience of the individual?
Representative Ms. Tolman.
Chair Ehart and Representative Hostetler, I would say that the non-discrimination ordinances like this actually don't regulate the beliefs and the religious beliefs of people. That is protected under the Idaho Human Rights Act. All it regulates is the conduct of people. It's asking people to treat people in a neutral way if you're offering goods and services to the community. And so I would argue that religious belief is actually not affected or being regulated by a non-discrimination ordinance.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of find that contradictory. We can look back to last year, House Bill 59.
Representative, let me just remind you, if we could, to keep it to a question. Were you going to ask a question?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Just in relation to that, we had passed House Bill 59, Medical Ethics Defense Act, which had set a precedent, essentially protecting the rights and the conscience of our medical industry, if you will. I see this very similar. Do you not see that they're not being forced to perform things that go against their conscience, if you will? And I see this being a continuation in the same arena. Do you not see that?
Ms. Tolman?
With House Bill 59, I would say that that is like a specific bill aimed at medical professionals who were performing things like gender-affirming care that ran afoul of their personal beliefs. We are widely talking about people, me being able to be kicked out of a restaurant with my family just because I went there to eat and I happened to be there with my wife. I do see that as a wildly different scenario.
Hey, my name is Kathy Grismeyer. I'm the Director of Policy and Government Affairs for the City of Boise, and I stand before you today in opposition to House Bill 557 because it removes local control and policy decisions by city leaders, while also rolling back key non-discrimination protections for Boise residents in housing, employment, and public accommodations. Boise's ordinance was adopted in 2012. It was driven by constituent outreach and feedback. We were hearing from members of the LGBTQ community that they feared reporting crimes to police for fear that they would be outed at their jobs and lose access to meaningful employment or to their job or to their homes, excuse me. And at the City of Boise, we have a mission here to create a safe, healthy, and livable community where everyone is free to live, work, and play with those and without any statewide protections. Again, as was said earlier, the City of Boise felt like it was important to step in and address those gaps so that all hardworking residents have a chance to earn a living and support their families. By way of nature of what our ordinance does, we do prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And was mentioned in 2023, our anti-discrimination ordinance was also amended to include source of income and housing to protect those using housing vouchers or child support. Again, that was driven by constituent feedback based on renters that were reaching out to city leaders talking about the difficulties in Boise's housing market, which is one of the most difficult in the state, and really tried to assure that there were some provisions we could in place to help protect the way that they're choosing to pay for their rent. We do have a standard municipal misdemeanor punishable, excuse me, we do have a standard municipal punishment ordinance, so it's punishable by a fine up to $1,000 or 6 months in jail. However, the city focuses its compliance on education first and allows prosecutors to assess a $100 fine if a violator takes a corrective action. I want to highlight that the city's ordinance also has important protections for the First Amendment and freedom of religion that align with current state law. So just to be explicitly clear, the ordinance does not apply to religious corporations, associations, educational institutions, or societies. This allows religious groups to prioritize members of their own faith in hiring and housing related to their religious mission. It contains an exception for expressive associations. These are nonprofits or groups whose primary purpose is to communicate a specific message. If employing a person would significantly burden the group's ability to advocate its viewpoints, they are exempt. Additionally, owner-occupied housing, such as small-scale rentals where a homeowner may rent a room in their house, are also exempt. If these are good enough for the state, we feel that they are appropriate for a city ordinance as well.
My name is Tom Wheeler. I'm a real estate team owner, business owner, and soon-to-be Boise State MBA graduate. I'm here representing Idaho's number one LGBTQ-owned real estate team. I strongly oppose HB 557. Over the past several years, our team has served more than 230 Idaho buyers and sellers and closed over $120 million in real estate sales volume. This year alone, we're on track to sell $50 million across 70 transactions. That means jobs, relocation dollars, new business, and long-term investment flowing into the great state of Idaho. House Bill 557 puts that economic momentum at risk. As housing professionals, we operate at the front door of Idaho's economy. We work daily with relocating professionals, doctors, engineers, and entrepreneurs, but also seniors, retirees, single individuals, and first-time homebuyers. Across all of those groups, one factor increasingly influences whether someone chooses Idaho. Is this a place where I will be welcomed, or where my employer or employees can thrive? Bills like House Bill 557 make Idaho cities less competitive in answering that question. They discourage talent from moving here, create hesitation for employers considering expansion, and reduce demand across our housing market. The bill argues for uniformity, but in practice, it strips local communities of the tools they use to stay economically competitive in a national marketplace. When businesses or skilled workers perceive Idaho as unpredictable or unwelcoming, they don't compromise. They choose another state. That means fewer jobs, fewer buyers, fewer transactions, and slower economic growth. Let me be clear. We are already seeing buyers and employers pause or reconsider investing here because of signals sent by legislation just like this. I urge you to oppose House Bill 557, not only because of who...
Moscow Mayor Haley Lewis also testified against the bill in the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to submit remarks on behalf of House Bill 557. My name is Haley Lewis, and I am the recently elected mayor of Moscow. I want to formally share my opposition to this bill, specifically on the grounds of preempting local control. I understand that Idaho uses both Dillon's rules and home rule, which make for a broad understanding of what local control means. But oftentimes, many well-meaning bills proposed, particularly in the last several years of legislative sessions, including this bill, House Bill 557, are seen and felt by cities and counties as running counter to the messaging we so often hear from state legislators who speak in favor of small government. My note said 13, but with Sandpoint's repeal, with the 12 cities and three counties with existing ordinances that would be impacted by this bill if passed, be held accountable by our electorate if their constituents would change. That is small government, and that is local control. This bill does not fix city budgets, property tax pain points, or help with interagency collaboration. I believe there are a number of opportunities for this committee and the body to advance bills that seek to solve budgetary and service problems that do impact every Idahoan and taxpayer. For context, the city of Moscow passed an anti-discrimination ordinance in 2013, prior to my time serving on Moscow City Council. And the ordinance, which was 2013-06, had the stated intention that all persons are treated fairly and equally in the city of Moscow. I believe this ordinance stemmed from citizens' requests to do so. And to my knowledge, the city has not cited anyone for violating any of the provisions in our code. I'm happy to answer any questions. But again, we oppose this bill on the grounds of preempting local control. Thank you.
That was Moscow Mayor Haley Lewis testifying before the Idaho House Local Government Committee yesterday. We also heard from Tom Wheeler, a Boise area real estate broker, preceded by Boise City Policy and Government Affairs Director Kathy Grismeyer, preceded by Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocate State Director Misty DeLiCarpini-Tolman, and we started with Victor City Council Member Sue Lancaster. Proponents of Representative Scoggs' local preemption law, getting rid of city anti-discrimination ordinances, say the local laws have been weaponized against small businesses. One man testified to the committee that homosexuality is a perversion. The committee passed the bill 13-3 and sent it to the House floor with both Democrats on the committee, Steve Birch of Boise and Monica Church of Boise, voting against, as well as Republican Representative Rick Cheatham of Pocatello. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP programming is sponsored by listeners like you and by Essential Art Gallery and Fine Gifts at 203 South Main Street in Moscow, showcasing high-quality art, pottery, jewelry, art glass, sculptures, scarves, textiles, wood and metal art, and fine chocolate and gifts from regional, national, and international artists. KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
Censorship is happening in higher education institutions across the nation, including Idaho, according to a new report. PEN America's analysis looks at state legislatures that succeeded in banning certain kinds of speech in the classroom. One of the laws explored in the report is Idaho's Senate Bill 1198, passed last April, which bans DEI offices on college campuses and prohibits colleges from requiring a course that is derived from or promotes critical race theory or DEI. Amy Reed with PEN America explains this law was categorized as an indirect form of censorship because it doesn't explicitly stop discussion, but rather puts up guardrails that are likely to make faculty wary of certain topics in their classrooms.
Indirect censorship is censorship, whether we're talking about a DEI ban or a curricular control measure or an attack on a faculty senate. Each of these things results in censorship, and our students nationwide deserve better than that.
Supporters of the law believe DEI and critical race theory are used to indoctrinate students. The PEN America report says 93 bills were introduced to censor higher education in 32 states. 21 of the bills became law in 15 states. The effort to limit topics discussed at colleges has intensified under the Trump administration. Reed claims the crackdown on free speech in college classrooms mirrors the anti-communist McCarthyism of the 1950s.
We at PEN America want to ensure that when students go away to college, they are given the freedom and the responsibility of engaging with ideas and making up their minds. We don't want someone else censoring the material and making their minds up for them.
The PEN America report says more attacks on higher education are expected to continue in 2026. That includes the possibility of U.S. Supreme Court involvement over the question of whether the speech of faculty at public universities is protected under the First Amendment. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
One of the top 2% scientists in the world says machine learning is necessary for researching biodiversity and determining which species are under threat because scientists cannot use DNA data because the DNA of 90% of plant species has not been mapped. University of Idaho biology professor Jack Sullivan, who spoke at the Renfrew Colloquium at the University of Idaho Library today, said scientists use machine learning, which is a form of artificial intelligence, to create virtual ecosystems, such as for a rainforest, and that can help determine where species are at risk. Sullivan said the systems are needed because the planet is facing a biodiversity crisis.
Since I was a graduate student, you know, 30 years ago, biologists have been concerned about this kind of biodiversity crisis. When we look around, we see a huge number and variety of species are disappearing. And this is the pace of this has been increasing as my career has gone on. And so obviously we need to figure out ways to increase the pace of biodiversity science and to find ways to allocate limited resources. And these are both human and financial. And so this is kind of what leads us to using machine learning, and we'll develop predictive approaches to biodiversity using machine learning. Machine learning is a branch of AI which is much maligned these days, right? And for some good reasons, right? But it's like any tool. It has good uses and bad uses. And the particular branch of machine learning that we'll focus on is one that you're subject to on a daily basis, and that's supervised machine learning, where we have predictor data sets that we build models from to predict behavior. So Amazon buys your browsing history from Google, right? Then your browsing history is the training database, and they predict what ads you'll buy, or you know, the ads that they'll show you. So we're gonna kind of use an approach to machine learning called random forest to build predictive models about two difficult to study aspects of biodiversity. One of them is the discovery of cryptic diversity. I'll define that, and we'll spend most of our time talking about that. And the other actually is surprising that it's difficult, is assessing conservation status.
Cryptic diversity is the presence of a previously unrecognized species that exists with what biologists had previously thought was a single species. Professor Sullivan spoke about Random Forest, which is a computer model and data set based on the Pacific Northwest's disjunct rainforests.
We know really a lot about rainforests on the coast. These coastal temperate rainforests are really well characterized, occurring up and down the coast and Cascade ranges. What's often not understood as well, or not known as well, is that as we traverse eastward, we see rainforests recurring. So there's an inland rainforest really in our backyard. So you can see here's Moscow, right? Here's kind of the distribution of the inland rainforest, and it occurs throughout much of northern Idaho, catches a little bit of Washington, Montana, and goes up into BC. All right, so if we put these two segments on the same map, we can see there's the coastal and Cascade segment of the inland rainforest, right? It's separated then by this really dry or xeric Columbia Basin, and these wet forests recur in northern Idaho, kind of the inland rainforest. Develop a random forest of 1,000 decision trees, and when we do that, using the same methods that we just went through, we can develop prediction accuracies of 82%. And that's actually still pretty good in machine learning kind of the world. So the scary thing, though, is when we apply this to the global plant data set, about 48% of the taxa that have not yet been assessed are predicted to be under some degree of threat. So we really have a lot of work to do. Interestingly, and probably not surprisingly, the variables that are the most predictive with respect to plant conservation status are rain size variables. To me, that's kind of gives us confidence in our predictor, because just kind of the gestalt view has long been that species with small ranges are under more threat than species with large ranges. There's another cool thing we can do with this data, and we can take all of those taxa that we predict to be under some degree of threat and plot them on the map and see if there's hot spots.
That was University of Idaho biology professor Jack Sullivan. Sullivan says scientists can use the machine learning to direct research into areas where it's most needed to address the world's biodiversity crisis.
We're going to develop a random forest of 1,000 decision trees. And when we do that, using the same methods that we just went through, we can develop prediction accuracies of 82%. And that's actually still pretty good in machine learning kind of the world. So the scary thing, though, is when we apply this to the global plant data set, about 48% of the taxa that have not yet been assessed are predicted to be under some degree of threat. Right, so we really have a lot of work to do. Interestingly, and probably not surprisingly, the variables that are the most predictive with respect to plant conservation status are rain size variables. To me, that's kind of gives us confidence in our predictor, because just kind of the gestalt view has long been that species with small ranges are under more threat than species with large ranges. There's another cool thing we can do with this data, and we can take all of those taxa that we predict to be under some degree of threat and plot them on the map and see if there's hot spots of plant threat. And indeed, there are. A lot of the plants that are threatened occur in the western U.S. A lot occur in Indonesia. There's a lot of threatened plants in southwestern Australia, etc. So what this does is this directs us. This is where we need to focus our research on assigning conservation status. Okay, so I think predictive modeling in biodiversity is really promising. You know, AI for sure is a bugaboo, but it's like any technology. We can use it for benign and even beneficial purposes.
Data available in these publicly available databases can provide really accurate predictors for the presence or absence of cryptic diversity. All right, what that means is we can make predictions about cryptic diversity for taxa that we have no genetic data for yet, and that can kind of inform our management policies. And machine learning can be applied to biodiversity databases to predict plant conservation status.
That was University of Idaho biology professor Jack Sullivan. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. The Spokane City Council member Paul Dillon has introduced an ordinance that would ban ICE from deploying on public property in the city without a judicial warrant. The city already has an ordinance banning ICE from warrantless enforcement at events on public property. The council passed that law in August. The new ordinance expands on that by making any city-owned or controlled property immigration enforcement-free zones. But it exempts open spaces such as parks. If passed, the law would prevent ICE from staging surveillance, processing, interviewing, or temporarily detaining people for civil immigration enforcement. The ordinance would also require the city to post signs around properties in both English and Spanish saying this property is owned and controlled by the city of Spokane. It may not be used for civil immigration enforcement, including use as a staging area, processing area, or operations base. The Spokane Council tried to move an ordinance barring federal immigration authorities from parks last year, but the Parks Board pushed back and the council tabled that ordinance. Councilmember Dillon's ordinance gives people the right to sue if immigration agents violate the law. The Spokesman Review reports Police Chief Kevin Hall has said he does not want any ordinance that would have his officers attempting to arrest ICE officers. Hall told council members Monday, if you have one armed law enforcement agency confronting another armed law enforcement agency, there are going to be problems. However, in response to a question from council member Sarah Dixit, Hall admitted Washington law requires officers to intervene. He said, my caution with that is Washington state's a little bit different because we have a duty to intervene law, meaning the officers, if they see another law enforcement officer, state, local, federal, doing something that they believe is unethical, criminal, or excessive force, they are duty-bound to intervene. City Transportation Commission member Kaylee Jackman said the law might not be effective if police won't arrest violators. Jackman asked, what good are lawsuits and settlements to injured parties once they are deported, quote, or killed due to the deplorable, unsafe, unsanitary detention centers?
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of North Central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
Without warning or provocation, federal agents attacked thousands at a Portland anti-ICE march, including children and elders, with tear gas on Saturday. There were actually two federal tear gas attacks at the Portland ICE facility on protesters. Once as a march including thousands of protesters was going by the ICE facility Saturday afternoon, with many choosing to stay at the ICE facility instead of circling back to where the march began, and the second time on a group of 300 who stayed at the ICE facility to continue protesting despite the first tear gas attack. Federal agents shot tear gas canisters, pepper balls, and flashbang grenades at the group before 6 p.m. Saturday. The Portland Mercury reported Portland Police Bureau officers looked on but did not intervene as federal agents violated a brand new Portland ordinance outlawing the deployment of tear gas outside of detention facilities. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield said people with video or accounts of unlawful behavior by federal agents should contact the Oregon Department of Justice. Portland City Council member Mitch Green, who was impacted by tear gas at the event, called on Mayor Keith Wilson to speed up enforcement of the city's new detention center fee ordinance, which became law January 2nd. That law makes it a violation for agencies to deploy tear gas at detention facilities. Mayor Wilson issued a statement Saturday saying the city is moving swiftly to operationalize the code change. Wilson wrote, "As we prepare to put that law into action, we are also documenting today's events and preserving evidence. The federal government must and will be held accountable." Wilson's statement called for the resignation of ICE officers. He said, "Through your use of violence and the trampling of the Constitution, you have lost all legitimacy and replaced it with shame. To those who continue to make these sickening decisions, go home, look in a mirror, and ask yourselves why you have gassed children." The march had come from a mid-afternoon rally at Elizabeth Carruthers Park, which is a few blocks north of the ICE facility. A coalition of Portland area labor groups organized the family-friendly event in solidarity with victims of the Trump crackdowns. Oregon AFL-CIO Union Federation President Graham Traynor said at the rally, "The labor movement's guiding principle is solidarity. That means that anything that aims to undermine our solidarity or divide our communities is a effing labor issue," using the full profanity.
You remember Project 2025, don't you? That insane playbook unveiled during the campaign. Take a guess on how much of that playbook has already been implemented. 51 or 2%, thanks, Tim. As they always say, when people tell you who they are, we should believe them, shouldn't we? And that's exactly what has happened. Now let's take a quick look at some of that list. In addition to the being the biggest union buster in United States history, with his attacks on federal workers and their unions, and stealing health care and food assistance from millions of working class people, and canceling billions of dollars in investments in clean energy projects, and ramrodding the largest transfer of wealth from working people to billionaires in American history through Congress. And as if that wasn't enough to try to overwhelm us, look at the hateful Project 2025 aligned mass deportation agenda that has wreaked complete havoc on our communities, on our immigrant siblings, and continues to escalate and antagonize. Boo! Addition, as we face these unprecedented times with chaos in our streets and escalating tensions stoked by this administration, targeting states like Oregon and cities like Portland, our job in the labor movement is to also see ourselves as trade unionists who are part of the resistance to rising authoritarianism. Am I right? Yeah. And the trampling of our fundamental freedoms and rights and the democracy defenders that we are and always have been. Are you with me on that? So here's the thing. Here's the thing. Being here is a great step, and I'm honored to be with you all here. And we need to keep showing up for our immigrant siblings and communities in the weeks and months ahead. But that alone isn't enough to prepare for the type of peaceful resistance needed to protect those being targeted. So if you haven't already, you need to attend a Migrant Watch training with the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition and support Pacoon and their escalating Day Without an Immigrant Coalition and campaign. You need to bug the hell out of your elected leaders to embolden them as they fight against these inhumane ICE operations in Congress and at the state capitol. And I would just say especially the immigrant justice package of bills that was just introduced ahead of the upcoming legislative session. You need to find a de-escalation training to attend to be best prepared to engage in peaceful protest and neighborhood-based efforts. Can you do that? And I'm just going to end with saying, find your people, find your community and your union to engage with in this resistance, because we can never let them take our voice and we can never let them take our joy. Am I right?
The rally came a week after the ICE killing of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis and the day after the January 30th shutdown in which hundreds of Portland high school students walked out and dozens of businesses closed for the day. The Portland Mercury reported as people lined up at Elizabeth Carruthers Park to march to the ICE facility, organizers told the crowd they don't disparage any protest tactic, but they wanted the march to commit to remaining peaceful. The crowd, including many children, replied in the affirmative. Organizers had expected the group to march past the ICE facility and return to Elizabeth Carruthers Park, which is what those in the lead of the march did at about 4:20 p.m. But some protesters chose to stay in front of the ICE facility. Federal agents deployed their chemicals, including several rounds of tear gas, on that group, plus those at the back of the march, without warning at about 4:30 p.m. 63-year-old Lisa Morrison, who attended the rally with her 78-year-old husband and retired Amalgamated Transit Unit member Bud Erland, told the Mercury, "I knew the union organizers were committed to a peaceful, family-friendly march, so we did not expect to be gassed, and we were in no way prepared to shield ourselves." She said they were marching on South Moody Street in a crowd that included peaceful people of all ages, including elders and babies, when the federal agents began their tear gas and flashbang attack, causing her and her husband to become overcome with burning eyes, noses, throats, and skin. Morrison said, "We were blinded and started coughing and retching." She said she continued to feel the effects of the tear gas into the rest of the evening and the next day. A large number of people at the back of the march left the area immediately, but some stayed at the ICE facility after the first attack, chanting, blowing bubbles, and dancing as volunteers cleaned up tear gas canisters and spent flashbang grenades. That's when federal agents hit the smaller group with tear gas and flashbang grenades, creating a cloud of gas and smoke that stayed in the air outside an affordable housing complex adjacent to the ICE facility. And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it will be mostly cloudy tonight with patchy fog after 8 p.m. Partly sunny tomorrow, patchy fog before noon, high 53. Mostly clear, low 37 Wednesday night, patchy fog after 9 p.m. and mostly sunny on Thursday, high 54. Currently 45 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can send your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. There's also more ways to help KRFP on the KRFP website. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. I'm Lee Robartos. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Flashpoints is up next, and then live in the studios at 7:30, we'll have Rude Awakening, so stay tuned for that. Brent Bent's in to play music for you starting at 9:30, and at 11 o'clock, we will have Sons of Patriarchy. Stay tuned for more. KRFP Moscow Pullman.